Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation.
Let's go to our first email. This one is from Serafina in Soquel. Serafina writes, high blood pressure medications. Are there any archives that discuss high blood pressure medications and treatments? My doctor has prescribed lisinopril, and I already take Celebrex, so I am concerned and fear a conflict. Well, Serafina, I think that you have a point. Celebrex tends to mute or fight a little bit with some blood pressure medications, specifically diuretics, and the group of drugs called angiotensin-converting enzyme inhibitors, and also the group of drugs called angiotensin receptor blockers. So you might expect that we're looking at a concern. And the main issue here is that you might need to use higher doses of lisinopril. And I also saw a caution when I looked it up on how they both might affect the kidney adversely. So I think it'd be worthwhile to think about a different agent. I next looked at the ARBs, but they too carry you may need to take more if you're on Celebrex, so that doesn't sound great. Typically what happens, I think, in these interactions is that a person is well controlled with their blood pressure, and then they start the Celebrex, and they start to have an impaired effect. So this is a different thing. This is actually more along the lines of the effect being perhaps, you know, you'd like to take the lowest possible dose of your blood pressure medication. So you might want to look into drugs called calcium channel blockers. Seems like every blood pressure medication has an annoying side effect, but this one at least does not have an interaction with Celebrex. It does potentially have a problem with causing a little swelling of the ankles. I generally tell my patients when they start this agent for the first couple of weeks to wear airplane socks, or if you don't want to wear socks, knee socks, wear pantyhose. I can usually get the women to do support pantyhose, not the men. But this helps a lot. And after a couple of weeks, this leg swelling thing sort of goes away for the most part, and people generally tolerate the drug well. Beta blockers also have their annoying side effects. They're actually really good if you are a nervous type person, or particularly if you get palpitations or racing heart. People often take beta blockers before they give a speech, for example. Although the doses that are used to control hypertension can cause drowsiness or low energy in certain people, and it can also contribute to depression. So as you can see, there's a lot to be thought of here. I wanted to take a moment and just give you a suggestion, and this is for the entire audience, folks. When you're on a series of medications, it's always good to check the interactions. If you simply are looking at, well, I'm only on one drug and they want to add a second drug, just go ahead and put the names of both drugs joined by an and, like, for example, Celebrex and lisinopril in the current question, and you will get an answer right away. The oracle of the web will provide you with indications whether or not you need to be worried about this. So I hope that's helpful. We're now going to go to our next email that I thought was important for us to address. And this comes from Patricia in Santa Cruz. Subject, mammograms and COVID vaccinations. This article discusses the timing of mammograms in relation to vaccinations. Since the vaccine can cause swollen lymph nodes in the armpit, the recommendation is to get mammograms either before vaccination or sometime after the second one. I don't know how authoritative this source is, but it does make kind of sense, doesn't it? Well, indeed, it sort of does, because we do see on the consent for both the Pfizer-BioNTech and the Moderna vaccine that lymph node swelling in the lymph nodes of the armpit is listed. I did a little investigating, And I found a recommendation, which I think was the basis for the Good Morning America link that you sent me. The Society of Breast Imaging, SBI recommendations for the management of axillary adenopathy in patients with recent COVID-19 vaccination. You see, here's the problem. You don't want to have to go biopsying lymph nodes in people or doing extra studies when it's a false positive. So I'll just read their statement. Axillary adenopathy in women with otherwise normal screening mammograms is rare, reported in 0.02 to 0.04 of screening mammograms. Reported malignancy rates are highly variable, from 20 to 56%, and very few published studies include women with unilateral or bilateral adenopathy that was due to a non-breast primary. Axillary adenopathy has been rarely reported following administration of BCG, influenza, and HPV vaccines. However, higher rates have been reported with administration of both the COVID-19 vaccines currently authorized for emergency use by the U.S. Food and Drug Administration. For patients receiving the Moderna COVID-19 vaccine, axillary swelling or tenderness, lymphadenopathy, was a solicited adverse event. In other words, they asked people if they had it during the vaccination trials. And it was found in 11% of patients versus 5% for placebo. Now, if you get an infected cut on your hand, you might get a lymph node, and so that would you'd be in that 5% if you got the placebo. This was 11% following dose 1 and 16% versus 4.3% for placebo, so in other words, the same rate effectively for placebo, in patients following dose number 2. In the Pfizer-BioNTech COVID-19 vaccine, lymphadenopathy was only reported as an unsolicited adverse effect. So you got 58 more cases in the vaccine group than the placebo group, 64 versus 6, but they were not specifically asked about it. So they had to volunteer that, like check the other box and then write in swollen lymph node. Lymphadenopathy in this study occurred in either the arm or neck within 2 to 4 days of vaccination and lasted for a mean of 10 days. The duration of adenopathy in both trials were based on physical examination. So you might have subclinical adenopathy that would show up on the mammogram. Those cases where people have had the COVID-19 vaccine and had a mammogram that was positive for a lymph node, it's always been on the side of the vaccination. So what they're suggesting at the end, and I'll just cut to the chase, is that you probably want to give a little bit of time after your COVID vaccine, before you get your mammogram, if it's appropriate. If you're getting a diagnostic mammogram for a breast lump, then you may want to just get that study and get a biopsy rather than wait for the 12 weeks that they're recommending. You know, that's 3 months, and if you actually have something suspicious, you probably don't want to wait 3 months. But I would leave that to a discussion with you and your doctor, because obviously it's a nuanced issue. I would recommend to people not to delay if they are in age groups or work groups that are currently being given vaccine. I really think you should consider going forward. All right. This from Sybil in SoCal. We have a lot of euphonious people today. Sybil writes, vaccine and resveratrol. First question, a friend of mine argued about the vaccine, and because I'm not a scientist, I'm in need of a comeback. She said the COVID tests have never been licensed for clinical trials, and there is a lawsuit underway against Torsten, who initiated the test. Okay, so let me just address that one. All of the rapid tests are under EUA. Licensed for clinical trials is something we takes a couple of years. We don't really have time for that. So the tests are indeed homegrown. However, the validation between the tests, that is to say both the PCR tests for RNA and within themselves, the various labs that are doing them and entities that are providing these tests, those tests are in fact consistent. The same sample tests positive at the same number of amplification steps. The other thing is the cycle time, so the CT it's called, and basically this is how many cycles of amplification to find something. If something's positive after 20 to 25 cycles of amplification, it's positive. That person has a lot of virus on their specimen. If something has to be amplified 50 or 70 times to be positive, you may be getting a false positive, and certainly the chances of that person being infectious are very, very low. So where you set that cycle time is super important on the PCR tests. That being said, licensed for clinical trials, when you're talking about someone sticking a swab in your nose, is really not the point. The point is inter-laboratory variability. That's our validation. Then she further states that the virus has never been isolated. And that is clearly a misinterpretation of something that may have been said on the news or in an article. We have this virus. We couldn't analyze it and break down its DNA if we didn't have it, and we couldn't grow it. So that's just plain wrong. Okay. She is further convinced that there are nanoparticles and other damaging agents that cross the blood-brain barrier. Okay, nanoparticles. We have nanolipids that form the surface of the particle, which is not a nanoparticle, that fuses with the cell wall in the vaccine. So if you actually understand the difference between nanolipids and nanoparticles, you don't have to be too worried about that one. Other damaging agents that cross the blood-brain barrier depends on the blood-brain barrier. But let me tell you, if you have a permeable blood-brain barrier, the vaccine could give you brain fog. It could make your brain inflamed, and you could feel foggy and like your brain wasn't working right, just the way that you feel when you're coming down with the flu. And it's basically those same chemicals when you are coming down with a virus. They're released by your white blood cells. In the case of a vaccine, the vaccine sends a signal to the white blood cells, and they release these chemicals, which cause the immune system to react to the agent and form immunity. Yes, the signaling chemicals do cross the blood-brain barrier, and they can have an effect on you, but it's not permanent because the brain has very sophisticated reversal techniques. And you know what? The effect of a COVID infection on the brain is orders of magnitude worse, as anyone with long COVID will be happy to tell you about at length. She further warns against the vaccine because, quote, RNA vaccine can attack our own DNA. Okay, that's another blatant falsehood. The RNA vaccine cannot get into the place where our DNA is. Our DNA is in the nucleus. The RNA vaccine is grabbed up by ribosomes in the cytosol, that is to say, the part outside the nucleus that forms the bulk of the area of the cell, and that's where the spike protein is manufactured, and the immune system gets taught how to deal with it. So, wow, okay, I think we've covered, Sybil, most of the things for your friend. I hope that will be helpful to you. You know, you can tell a lie by telling a half-truth. There's a lot of half-truths that are phrased in a way that makes them a lie, but you can't quite say it's a lie because it's a half-truth, so it's half-true. But how you understand it is where the lie comes in, and that's just blatant manipulation, which we should expect because, honest to God, the vaccine's working great, and we have got so much data now. I get a little ping the first month. I got it every week. Now, every day for the first week, every week for the first month. Now, I'm getting it less frequently. And I'm getting polled about vaccine side effects. And this is being collected for the, I think I heard 14 million people have been vaccinated so far. Two shots, fully vaccinated. So we've got a lot of data. And they aren't recalling this thing at this point. I think we're on a roll here. And it's terrible optics if you don't like vaccines. Let's come to the second question with Sybil. I've read somewhere that resveratrol taken as a supplement is estrogenic and should be avoided. Let me talk to you about this. H.H. Chow is a researcher who's done a lot of work with resveratrol. I looked at two of his articles. I'm going to tell you about one of them. But I want to just take a moment and talk about plants, okay? If you're on bioidentical estrogen or progesterone, you're basically taking something that starts out as, among other things, Mexican wild yam. Yeah, a kind of sweet potato. And they pull the molecule, which looks a lot like a cholesterol molecule, but it's got a few extra groups hung on it. I like to think of cholesterol as a blank charm bracelet. So you just tack a little charm there that memorializes your trip to Paris, and then you take a trip to Arizona or Texas, and you've got a little Alamo charm, or I don't know, whatever you, the cactus that makes you think about Arizona. And so these little side groups change what receptor the molecule can fit into. So the progesterone comes from cholesterol, fits into the progesterone receptor. But you can also take progesterone and run it through a few enzymatic pathways and get androstenedione. You know, that was the whole baseball steroid scandal, right? Andro, they called it. And if you take that a step further, you have testosterone. And if you take that another step further, you have estrogen, which can be converted into three different types, which we'll come back to in a moment. But the point is, these receptors are a little bit loosey-goosey. So you can have something like the drugs that are used for breast cancer, which are called the selective estrogen receptor modulators, or SERMs. Tamoxifen would be the one that you've probably heard of, and it sits on the estrogen receptor in the breast and blocks it from being stimulated by estrogen. But tamoxifen also goes and sits on the estrogen receptor in the bone and stimulates it to prevent osteoporosis. It also sits on the estrogen receptor in the uterus and stimulates it, so it can actually be influential there. So you see, it doesn't take much change in the slight shape of the receptor or change in the molecule to change its properties. So soy contains compounds called daisian and genestin. Both of these are phytoestrogen. Resveratrol is another phytoestrogen. And just like the stuff that comes off the Mexican wild yam, it can fit into the estrogen receptor. And it's a weak stimulator of the estrogen receptor. So whether or not it is a stimulator or a blocker depends upon how much estrogen there is around. This is one of the fascinating stories of soy. If you come from a culture where you eat a lot of soy, and you're eating a lot of soy when you go through puberty and your estrogen levels are really high, you're protected over your entire life from breast cancer, regardless of whether you keep eating soy, because your breast cells don't get as much stimulation, and so they're probably epigenetically different than the breast cells of young women who didn't have a lot of soy in their diet when they were going through puberty. Now, let's take someone who didn't have soy in childhood, and let's age them up to 55 when they get their breast cancer, which is estrogen receptor positive. And so this person might be placed on tamoxifen, or they might not. But in that person, if they're postmenopausal and they have very low levels of estrogen to be blocked, see, soy blocks the estrogen when there's a lot of it around, and it isn't as strong a stimulant. But when there's not any of it around, then it acts as a soft stimulant because it's not blocking estrogen, the strong stimulant. It's actually stimulating, and absent the soy, you wouldn't have that. So it could have an effect. We don't know for sure about soy and breast cancer. So if you've had breast cancer, you're told to avoid soy. The data on that is not really all that good, but that's really beside the point because we want to be very, very cautious about such things. So let's go to that clinical pilot study I showed you. What about resveratrol? Do we need to be worried about that? Quoting from Dr. H.H. Chow in the journal Translational Medicine, resveratrol, a phytochemical produced by a restricted number of plant species in response to stress, has shown compelling breast cancer preventative activities in preclinical studies. Resveratrol has been shown to suppress proliferation of both estrogen receptor positive and negative breast cancer cells in cell culture systems. It acts as an estrogen agonist or antagonist, depending on cell types, estrogen receptor isoform, like I was talking about with the tamoxifen, and presence of endogenous estrogens. So context, my dear, is extremely important here. Some, but not all studies show that resveratrol inhibits aromatase in breast cancer cells. This would be good, reducing the amount of estrogen available to stimulate those estrogen receptors. In addition, resveratrol has been shown to modulate phase 1 and phase 2 enzymes involved in the activation or detoxification of drugs, endogenous hormones, and carcinogens. So I'm going to tell you, after having read this article, I'm going to be recommending resveratrol to people with a history of atypia of the breast and people with a history of family, you know, strong family history of breast cancer as a category of won't hurt and might really help. So nothing to lose by taking it. In this study, they had a pilot group of postmenopausal women who were overweight, and they wanted to see what happened with systemic steroid hormones. Women who are overweight have higher levels of aromatase. They tend to have higher estrogen levels, and they also tend to break their estrogen down in a way that is more carcinogenic. I won't get into too much in the weeds, but you know, the order in which you cut those side groups off when you're breaking down estrogen can sometimes accidentally create a form of estrogen that is sticky and likes to go and stick to DNA, like lint. Now, this estrogen lint can interfere with the transcription of DNA, and so we would prefer to have as little of it as around as possible. Diet and certain supplements can make a big difference in pushing the body in the direction of breaking that estrogen down in the safer way. And the safer way is called 2-hydroxyestrone. So resveratrol did not result in significant changes in serum concentrations of estradiol, estrone, and testosterone in the blood, but led to a 10% increase in the concentration of sex hormone binding globulin. Now, this is good because that reduces the activity of the estrogen and the estrogen lint that might be floating around, not quite eliminated by the body yet. And actually, this estrogen lint that can attach to DNA, if you've got the wrong set of bacteria in your gut, you can actually trigger a recycling system that will recycle that estrogen back into the body and use it again. But now it's linty estrogen, and you don't want it there. So your gut health also plays in to your risk of breast cancer, which is something that I find rather amazing. The resveratrol group in this study had an average of 73% increase in their urinary 2-hydroxyestrone. That's the safe one, leading to a favorable change in the 2-hydroxy-16-alpha-hydroxy, that's not so good one, ratios. So 1 gram of resveratrol a day has favorable effects on estrogen metabolism. We need to do further studies, of course, they always say that, and it's always true. But I think from just my outline of this article, Sybil, you can see that all of the data implies that resveratrol is neutral to good. And yes, it's an estrogen, but it's a nuanced subject. Would I worry in people who already had breast cancer? Yeah, I'd probably not put them on resveratrol because I haven't got evidence in the absence postmenopausally. You're post-breast cancer, you're off your tamoxifen, can I take resveratrol? I don't know. So I'd probably tell you not to because we just don't have the data to prove it's safe. That's how it goes. Data comes before medical advice. And if you give medical advice based on expert opinion, I wish it would be labeled, you know, like, I'm sorry, all of the advice I'm about to be giving you may in fact not be based on science, but on expert opinion of people who have an academic reputation staked on it continuing to be true. Yeah. And guess who's going to be on those expert panels? The experts. Oh, well. Enough subversive commentary from Dr. Dawn. Let's talk about sleep and teenagers. I've been listening to the news and hearing all sorts of discussions about mental health issues. And, of course, the debate about schools and the loss of social contact with the peer group. Just so many PhD theses are going to come out of this lovely year or two that we are experiencing. Teenagers are especially vulnerable to sleep disorders. Sleep is especially critical for them because they're at an age when they're going through a whole range of physical, hormonal, social, and developmental changes, all of which, in order for them to go well, depend on getting enough sleep. Research shows that teenagers need at least 8 hours of sleep each night. And here's where it gets scary. Without this, they're less able to deal with stressors, such as bullying or social pressures, and run the risk of developing behavioral problems as well as anxiety and depression. If sleep drops to less than 6 hours a night, teenagers are twice as likely to engage in risky behaviors such as dangerous driving, marijuana, alcohol or tobacco use, risky sexual behavior, or other aggressive or harmful activities. In Australia, almost 1 in 7 children will experience a mental health disorder. That they're calling that age 4 through 17. While half of all mental health conditions start by the age of 14, most cases go undetected and untreated. And now, more than ever, this is a concern. Technology is one of the greatest defenders of the many factors that contribute to later bedtimes for teenagers. Teens spend a lot of time on devices, texting friends, playing games, watching videos, and using technology late into the night is one of the most common disruptors of good sleep. Overuse of technology is known to contribute to mental health issues and increase anxiety in everyone. And not only can using technology make, well, it certainly makes me feel anxious and freaked out and annoyed, upgrade hell, but the blue light emitted from technology inhibits the production of the sleep hormone melatonin and delays the natural onset of sleep. And this is especially bad because teenagers already have a biological tendency, hormonally driven, can we say reproductive behavior? They want to stay up late and sleep in. This is something that we all need to think about. And if you have teenagers in your household or have one you love and you're wondering what to get them for a present, well, you can't take away the tech, but you can at least take away the blue light. Taking away the blue light can involve using glasses. The blue light filters and apps on the phones are not powerful enough, but if you can get the light shifted to an orange color, it really, really helps with that piece. Also, having sleep or relaxation apps on their phones, because they love apps. So let's get them something like Headspace, which has a sleep series. And looking for a present that can be purchased, and maybe they'll listen to it, and maybe they'll actually sleep. It is extremely important that we do everything we can to educate our teenagers and their parents about how critical it is to get enough sleep right now during this amazing time that we're going through. Now, sleep has been the subject of much research, but a recent bit of research published in Nature Communication looks at the science of siestas and whether or not it's genetically related or whether it's cultural. This was a collaboration between Massachusetts General Hospital and the University of Murcia in Spain, also several other institutions. And they identified dozens of gene regions that govern the tendency to take naps during the day. And they uncovered preliminary evidence linking napping habits to cardiovascular health. In some countries, daytime naps have long been part of the culture, for example, Spain. But now those countries are discouraging the habit. Meanwhile, some companies in the United States now promote napping as a way to boost productivity. So we have to really disentangle the biological from the cultural. So naturally, these researches, I'm not going to give you the list because it's a long list. Working with the genomes, and I'll talk about technology and techniques in a moment, they've identified genes that are associated with sleep duration, insomnia, the tendency to be an early riser or a night owl. So they did a genome-wide association study, which involves rapid scanning of complete sets of DNA of a large number of people. It's a machine learning technique, and the goal is always to identify genetic variations that are associated with a specific disease, or in this case, a habit. There are GWAS studies that you can do for breast cancer tendency, for example, where they've taken, you know, all the people with breast cancer, and what genes do they have in a higher frequency than the population that doesn't have breast cancer. The trouble is we don't know what any of the genes mean, and we're not sure about the epigenetics. With something like breast cancer, that limits the predictive value of this work. In this case, the researchers used the UK Biobank, which, you know, United Kingdom. So they've had national health since the late 40s. And as soon as there were computers, they started putting stuff on computers. And before that, they had paper records. And since they've paid for everybody's drugs, they've got a lot of data, and it can be data mined. So they have genetic information from, 452,633 people. All of the participants were asked whether they nap during the day, either never, rarely, sometimes, or usually. And the GWAS study identified 123 regions in the human genome that are associated with daytime napping. Now, a subset of the participants wore activity monitors called accelerometers, just like your watch that tells you how many steps you've taken. This provides data about daytime sedentary behavior, which can be an indicator of napping. And the self-reports of napping were accurate. So this gives us something that is real and measured, which is good because otherwise you're kind of guessing whether people are fibbing or not. So they also replicated their findings in another database, this the 541,333 people collected by 23andMe, who gave, I presume, permission to be de-identified and used in research and also filled out that bloody, God, it must have been 40-page questionnaire that I did all those years ago when I did it. So a significant number of genes near or at regions identified by the GWAS were already known to play a role in sleep, so that's another validation. One important example is a gene called KSR2, which had previously been found to play a role in sleep regulation. What they found, digging deeper into their data, is that several of the napping variants were already associated to a neuropeptide called orexin, which is a wakefulness hormone. This is a pathway that's known to be involved in narcolepsy, which is where people fall asleep during the day. And actually, orexin, when it's inhibited, or when there isn't enough of it, will cause you to fall asleep. And there is, in fact, one drug that is FDA approved. Its pharmaceutical name is suvorexant. That's S-U-V-O-R-E-X-A-N-T. And its trade name is the lovely euphonious Belsombra, B-E-L-S-O-M-B-R-A. Now, I've used this agent in my older people when I can get it. It's still quite expensive. I can't wait for it to go generic because it worked quite well. It inhibited orexin and essentially induced a state of narcolepsy, but it wore off and they woke up in the morning and it really helped their sleep. Eventually, this will become, I think, a major hit as soon as the company stops charging through the nose for it and having it be off formulary. But it's likely to be much safer for people who have a family history of dementia or are starting to show signs of cognitive defect, which is why I really like it, because it stays off of the acetylcholinergic pathways, which is where dementia lives. So what this tells us is that daytime napping is biologically driven. You're not lazy. You just like to take a nap. And it tells us that it's not cultural. At least, I guess there's, you know, maybe there's a lot of people in Spain with this gene. And certainly a lot of people who weren't sleeping during siesta time were probably having a lovely big lunchtime and enjoying the pleasures of laughing and talking with friends, which of course impacts their productivity, which is why the Spanish government has decided to discourage it. There seems to also be some association between daytime napping and cardiometabolic health issues like elevated blood pressure and large waist circumference, but the GWAS study did not check for sleep apnea, and so I think that is what we call a classic confound. You identify people who are napping during the day. This is true. But if you don't also look at sleep apnea, you'll never be sure whether those people were napping because they weren't getting enough adequate sleep at night. So we have to be careful about drawing conclusions on any of these things. And that's also true of our next study, which I like to say that sitting is the new smoking. In this case, a study looked at prolonged sedentary time and distractibility in overweight or obese adults. And they used those accelerometers again to track daily activity levels for a week in 89 adults with obesity and measured their ability to multitask and maintain their attention despite distraction. The study revealed that individuals who spent more sedentary time, particularly if they sat for 20 minutes or more, were less able to overcome distractions. Several studies examined the relationship between different types of sedentary behaviors, such as TV viewing and cognitive functions, and these relationships varied with the type of sedentary behavior. So they're trying to narrow it down. What we do know from other studies is that regular sitting for extended periods is associated with increased mortality and cardiovascular disease. But again, you've got that problem of a confound, because maybe people who have heart disease are going to sit more because they get out of breath when they exercise. If you don't exclude for that, you may end up drawing a false conclusion. People who do not engage in at least 60 minutes per day of moderate, vigorous physical activity have an increased health risk. People who sit for 8 hours or more have an increased health risk. Other studies suggest that even 20 minutes of sitting can affect blood sugar levels after a meal. So there's a hint if you're insulin resistant and your doctor tells you that you're pre-diabetic, you want to get up and take a walk after you eat dinner. And even a 5 or 10 minute walk has been shown in previous studies, God, going back a decade, that it makes a difference in how high your blood sugar rises after that meal. So this study, however, was looking at attention, and they wanted to objectively measure it. They collected baseline information for all the participants and tested their cognitive ability and calculated their body mass index, and then they wore accelerometers on their waists during waking hours for 7 days. And then they went to the laboratory, completed some more cognitive tests and measures of brain function, and they used EEG recordings to measure the electrical potentials generated in the brain while they were engaged in tasks that challenged them to focus. And then during these research projects, they were given scientifically determined distractions, and they were tested on their ability to switch attention between tasks. A controller connected to a computer allowed them to respond to problems while the speed and accuracy of their responses was recorded. And then they did a statistical analysis and found that the more sedentary people were, the more distractibility they had in these tests. So if you stop and think about it, you're trying to concentrate, you're trying to focus, you're feeling like your cognition is drifting and you're not able to focus on a task, get up and take a brief walk. Move around. Go outside if you can. If you can't go outside, walk around. I have a feeling that those trips to the water cooler may actually have more value productivity-wise than meets the eye. Okay, we have an email from a listener. I always like to go to those first. This from David. I have a 15-year-old son who gets skin tested for food and environmental allergies. I'm suspicious about how and if these tests have been validated for all the possible allergens and their correlation with actual clinical allergy. He is an anaphylactic to peanuts, dairy, egg, and others. Do you know if skin prick testing has been validated for allergens other than the top 8 allergens? And actually, David, I used to do a lot of skin prick testing back in the day when it was actually reimbursed to primary care. And we did allergy testing, same thing, because we certainly can. And it was before the, let's say, the mutation of modern medicine into the hyper-specialized, multi-specialty group thing trying to find a polite word, that it is today. Okay, but getting back to your question, skin testing is actually only suggestive. And as far as that goes, blood testing is only suggestive. There are other factors involved besides whether your skin reacts to a substance and whether or not you're going to have an anaphylactic event when you're exposed to it. For example, people with known bee sting allergy can have a swelling and hives reaction with a documented amount of inoculum. So it's not like the bees' tanks were dry or something like that. But you can show that depending upon literally the phase of the moon, the menstrual cycle, how upset you are about breaking up with your girlfriend, you can be more or less likely to have an anaphylactic reaction. In fact, the time of day is even an influence. So how the heck are you going to validate this, is what I'm saying. So they are validated only for skin reactivity. The problem with that is that, again, people's reaction can vary from day to day, phase of the moon, menstrual cycle, all the other things, and many, many other things that I just listed. But if you test positive on a skin test, it's at least prudent to avoid those substances. And you can do desensitization therapy. And that, in fact, is, I would say, a very, very legitimate thing to be doing. There's something called sublingual immunotherapy. So if you have positive tests, you can get a very, 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 very dilute amount of the compound and start putting it under your tongue like you might do. There's many herbs and things, melatonin. There's drugs for migraine that you put under your tongue and let melt, and enough of it absorbs into the bloodstream to have an effect on the brain. And so this sublingual immune therapy is becoming more and more popular. I'm sure it's gotten a boost during COVID as well, because it allows you to very, very, very gradually work your way up. Now, if you're going to do this, the first thing I would say is consider it real and fix his microbiome, okay? If he's got that much anaphylactic and he's 15, his mother had had antibiotics, possibly his grandmother had had antibiotics, kid didn't get a good microbiome to start. He may or may not have been breastfed. That helps, but only if your mother has a good microbiome to start with. So fix his microbiome. Go see a functional medicine doctor. Get him on the right probiotics. Get him tested. Make get him on a diet that feeds the good stuff. And you will help reduce the magnitude of an accidental reaction. And this has been shown in asthma. And I see no reason not to extrapolate from asthma to anaphylaxis. Obviously, we're not going to do experiments to make people anaphylactic. However, we can measure increase in airway resistance in a controlled setting where we can reverse it. So that's okay. And if it works for asthma, I'm virtually morally certain it would work for your son. And what I want to emphasize here is that the studies on using probiotics and prebiotics are valid, and placebo and all of the things. And it's real data, and it's out there if you go search for it. Good luck. And like I said, fix his microbiome. Well, we've got about 8 minutes left, so I think I'm going to roll to a couple more emails to round out what I hope has been a very enjoyable show. This from an anonymous person in Santa Cruz. Thanks for your show. I apologize for a long email. I'm 63. In December, I began titrating off my bioidentical hormones that I've been on for 15 years. I've been off them since January and have had storming sweats ever since. I got off them because I'm an intuitive, and my body started saying no. I also douse and get a no. All right. I'm currently experimenting with low doses of DHEA and pregnenolone. Taking too much will also induce sweats, but without one or both, I sweat more often. I don't feel female. I don't feel male. I just don't feel anything. I'm bone dry, and I have also intense low blood sugar fluctuation. My sweats follow a weird pattern. They're very brief, 1 to 3 minutes. My body temperature remains low normal. They sometimes come every hour exactly on the hour. And they'll start about 7 p.m. and then 8:20, 9:20, and usually until about 1:20 in the morning, and then again right in the morning before I wake up. I'm not diabetic. My A1C is normal. And she goes on to tell me about her diet and all the good things she does for herself. And she does a lot. I'm wondering what test to consider. Of course, I'm going to a tumor, but consulting with Dr. Google, it seems like it could be anywhere. Tumor is like the last place I would go here, unless you were also getting diarrhea. I really just think you've told me what happened here, Anonymous, is that you stopped taking your hormones. And she follows later on, I love her title though, backstory, optional reading. I tried titrating off my hormones 5 years ago, so she would have been 57. And the nonstop storming of sweats and low blood sugar with night eating were so severe, I went back to a hormone specialist and got back on the same hormones. So, Anonymous, listen, you got to work on your stress. I consider these sweats to be a smoke alarm. It's been a stressful year. I remember the movie Airplane, where the chief air traffic controller keeps saying, "I picked a terrible day to stop drinking." And it's a running gif. It's just like, "Oh, quick, terrible, picked a terrible day to stop cocaine." And he just keeps riffing through worse and worse things. If you have not seen that movie, by the way, it is one of the all-time hoots. It still works even this many years later. Coming back to other ideas for you, I think that one test I would suggest would be a salivary cortisol test with a morning awakening response. This is an alternative test. You can get it from a company called Genova. And if you want, I'll work with you at my office to go further with you on this. But this will tell us whether or not your normal circadian rhythm is working, whether your cortisol levels are spiking in the middle of the night, and what's going on with your melatonin and your cortisol. Because if it's not doing what it's supposed to do, this could explain a lot of your symptoms. Now, in terms of what to do, I would recommend empirically, you could try using doses of melatonin, and you can use doses up to 20 milligrams. That can be very helpful with the sweats. You might also consider using estriol. Estriol is E3. It's the type of estrogen that is really only made by the body during pregnancy. And it's made during pregnancy because the hormone levels are so high that the body produces its own estrogen blocker, effectively. Estriol blocks estrogen's effect on the breast. It still gets through, as you can see. Anyone who's ever been pregnant can tell you that. But your breast would probably explode if you weren't making a whole bunch of estriol during pregnancy. Estriol can be helpful in the vagina for dryness. And I have had it be very successful in hot flashes. I don't know why you felt that you needed to stop bioidentical hormones. And so I think what I would do is, since you're a dowser and this is important for you too, is get a hold of some estriol and ask your body whether or not estriol is right for you, just like the commercial. And if your body is your doctor, and I'm respecting you for your view on the matter, you got to listen to it. I wouldn't go against it. But on the other hand, let's fact check by using estriol. The next step to do would be to look at urinary levels of neurotransmitter breakdown products, because if you're going to go to hormones, you're going to go to carcinoid, which would generally cause a lot of diarrhea along with the hot flashes, which is why I don't think that's going on. But looking at urinary byproducts of hormones, and these tests are generally done by alternative labs, again, would be a really effective place to start. And ruling out a tumor, if you're going to have one, which I doubt, that'd be where I started digging. I hope you've enjoyed this program, folks. I'll be back next week. For more of your questions, you can go ahead and email me. During the rest of the week, go to askdrdon.com and click the Contact Us. Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. Please go to askdrdon.com for news about our future plans, or follow my tweets at @AskDrDon. For now, this is Dr. Don saying so long and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Don is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Mansky. Music by John Scoville.